Today, I bring you the Greek god of wine, Dionysus, who in his spare time, as he's come down here to Earth, is a web engineer and freelance consultant. And he's been doing web back-end and front-end and security for a long, long time. And today, he's here to tell us about, as if JScript wasn't funky enough, client-side DSL. So I'm very much looking forward to this talk. Put your hands together for Dionysus.
My name is Dionysios Sinodinos. I'm a web engineer for NTUA, and working for a university gives me many opportunities to work on different new and interesting things, some of which might have little or no practical value. Also, I have some research experience in the mobile web, or at least what we thought the mobile web would be in early 2000, and also in hypermedia systems. And we're going to talk about JavaScript DSLs for the client side. Our presentation will go like this. First, we're going to talk a little bit about DSLs, just to give you a small foundation to build upon. Now, I understand this is a DSL conference, so many of these things you have either read them yourselves or have heard them before, but we need this in order to build a few concepts on top of it, and since these presentations are videotaped and will be probably played somewhere else. We'll talk a little bit about JavaScript, about the nature of the language. Now, this will not be an in-depth tutorial for the language. This is beyond the scope of the presentation. We'll just focus on why JavaScript is good in doing DSLs and its advantages and its disadvantages. Then we're going to talk a little bit about client-side frameworks and how these frameworks use DSL techniques to make developers more productive. Then we're going to talk about the challenges that come with HTML5. Now there are many APIs that will be exposed with a new version of HTML5, like APIs for offline storage, for WebSockets, for drawing 2D graphics, many interesting APIs, which although are designed in a really nice way, we should really use small DSL languages on top of them in order to use them effectively and make them more approachable. And finally, we're going to talk a little bit about how you can create your own JavaScript DSL. Now, there is a presentation by Adam Makria online, I think it's called Metaprogramming in JavaScript, where Adam goes step by step in designing his own JavaScript DSL. It's like 60 slides with a lot of code. So if you actually want to do your JavaScript DSL, you should probably also look at this presentation. But here I have summarized the steps he takes into building his DSL. So, a good way to start is with a definition. There are many definitions about DSLs, and there are people, arguing about these things. The essence for me is that a DSL is a programming language which is focused on a specific domain, and in this way it's highly expressive and compact for this domain. Some of the DSL characteristics are they are focused, and because of that they have expressive power for the problem domain that they were made for. They're usually small and they only provide a restricted set of functionality. They're not necessarily Turing complete, although many DSLs are Turing complete. They may contain an entire general purpose language as a sub-language. They are usually declarative, although this is not always the case. And the advantages that come with DSLs are that hopefully domain experts can understand, validate, and even develop their own DSLs. Now, this is probably the holy grail in many situations, and it's something similar to model-driven development, where you hope to have the domain experts do the models and the work. for this presentation for client-side JavaScript, your domain experts are people doing web development. There are people that understand about CSS, about typography, about colors, about human-computer interaction. And these people actually use these DSL techniques to develop their program. So this is not a holy grail for JavaScript, for client-side JavaScript. This is actually the way things are done. DSL programs are pretty much self-documenting, and you will see that we will look code pieces from several different frameworks, and even if you don't know these frameworks, you will probably understand what they are talking about. Oops. They embody domain knowledge, and it's much easier to reuse this domain knowledge, and they allow for validation and optimization at domain level. But with DSLs, there come many disadvantages, some of which were discussed even in last night's panel. There is a great cost in designing and implementing a DSL. There is also a great cost at maintaining a DSL. In the case of client-side JavaScript, this is much bigger than in most cases, since you have APIs that change and you have also the runtime changing, because you have all these different browsers which change constantly. And the cost of maintenance is usually not emphasized enough. You have the cost of educating your users. In the examples you are going to see, this is actually a small cost, because these JavaScript DSLs are very focused on the problem domains that come with web development. These problem domains are either DOM manipulation, communication with a server, AJAX style, and similar things. There's also a difficulty of balancing between domain-specific and general-purpose programming language constructs. And there is potential loss of efficiency when you compare DSL code with hand-coded software. Now, efficiency can mean many things. One thing that is easily understood is performance. For example, when you do heavy DOM manipulation with frameworks that do DSL-style programming, the performance is not that good when you compare it with hand-coded JavaScript. As many have said, there are two types. This is one way to categorize DSLs, with internal or embedded and external DSLs. With external DSLs, basically they have their own syntax. You create a parser or a compiler, and you have internal DSLs where you have a host language and you implement the DSL with this host language. This is the case for this presentation, internal DSLs in JavaScript. Now, some well-known DSLs are Make, Hunt, Nant, and Rake in the software builds domain. You have SQL for relational data manipulation. You have HQL and JPQL for object-oriented data manipulation. You have XSL for XML transformations. You have CSS for styling documents. You have regular expressions. And you have things like JavaFX script and similar technologies from Adobe for rich internet applications. Now, about the nature of the language. JavaScript is a simple, small, highly dynamic, object-oriented language. The word simple is in double quotes, because as you work with it and you discover its more powerful functional features, you can really shoot yourself in the leg with it. Your code can become much more complicated, and with a lack of namespaces and stuff like that, you can easily introduce bugs. It's a mixture of object-based and functional programming. And it's the only mainstream language that you will probably ever see which has prototype-based inheritance. This basically means that you don't have classes and objects created from those classes, but you have objects created by other objects and everything is pretty much a singleton, and this can get a bit weird if you haven't seen it before. Now JavaScript takes its major ideas from Self and Scheme. Self was pretty much an experimental language, but Scheme was heavily taught in the US in universities, and it never became as popular as Common Lisp, but even now you can find many software products that offer built-in embedded scripting support for Scheme, like GIMP, which is the GNU Photoshop. Its philosophy is very minimalistic, and it provides very few primitive notions, and you build your libraries on top of those notions. This is similar with Lisp, and the reason I'm mentioning both Scheme and Lisp is to show you that JavaScript inheritance makes it really powerful to implement DSLs with. So a few other things that are good about the language, you know, we can go quickly over them. It has a C-like syntax, and pretty much everybody understands C, so it's really easy to get the feel of it. It has an object-oriented syntax that looks like Java. This is both good and bad. It's good because you can understand easily, you know, when you start off with it, but since you don't have classes, for example, when you use the new operator to create object, it might create the illusion that you have classes, and this can quickly lead to, you know, mistakes and misconceptions. It has prototype-based inheritance, and there are many people advocating that prototype-based inheritance is very good in certain things, like you can easily do exploratory type of programming, and you can more quickly refactor your code. But these are all, of course, opinions. If you want to do anything in web development with HTML scripting, there are many products out there, but JavaScript is probably king. There are also many other products that support and technologies that support JavaScript. For many years, the only language you could have on top of an enterprise system like JVM was JavaScript, and you could do that with Mozilla Rhino. Now, of course, you have many different dynamic languages on top of the JVM. You can do lots of XML manipulation. You have built-in support for JSON. And it's the only mainstream language with real specifications. Now, these specifications actually are really badly written. And I think it was Douglas Crockford that said that the committee that actually made these specifications should be really ashamed about them. You cannot even use them as reference material. But if you are building a tool, maybe this will be helpful. And also you have support for enterprise systems with Java, Enterprise, and .NET. Of course, there are many things that people complain about when they work with JavaScript. One thing is the lack of namespaces. Of course, there are ways to... Also, the JavaScript doesn't have private members and stuff like that. There are techniques to emulate all these things. You don't have a method missing, and when you do DSLs, and you don't have a method missing, you can easily get into trouble. And for many people working with prototype-based inheritance, it's a bit awkward. So, we've seen a few characteristics of the language, but now let's see how these characteristics map to DSL patterns. I have gathered a few of the patterns that are mentioned in Martin Fowler's book, that are used in building DSLs, and we'll go through each and every one of them and see if you can implement them in JavaScript. So one pattern is method chaining. You actually create a host object, and the modifier methods return this same host object, so you can put many functions in one function call. You can do that with JavaScript, and it looks like this. And it's, you know, pretty easy to understand what this piece of code does. Get me an element, move it, change width, height. It's pretty self-documenting. One more pattern is the use of nested functions, where you can pass function calls as arguments to other functions. And again, you can do something like that with JavaScript, and it could look like something like this, which is similar to our previous example, but if you see the second function call, which creates an event listener, has an argument with which is a function call. Going forward, it's nice to have a convenient literal collection expression. You know, if you want to do DSLs, you basically need a way to have lists, maps, stuff like that. And you can do that with JavaScript, and this is an example. You can either create simple lists, or with JSON, you can even do more complicated collections. And you have built-in support for all these collections. Closures is yet another pattern used when you want to do DSLs. You actually, you know, it's a way to pass around a piece of code with limited context. And again, you can have closures in JavaScript. And this is a really simple example to show you how closures work in JavaScript. You have a function, which it's an object constructor, which has a variable which is a local variable, so you cannot access it outside of the object that will get created, and you have an accessor function and one more function that fits its stuff, so you can create the object, increment the local variable, and you can access it with the accessor method, but you cannot access it directly. Actually, this is the simplest way you can have private members in JavaScript, because it doesn't have a private keyword. One more pattern is our macros. You can either have textual or syntactic macros. Sorry, JavaScript has no macros. But there are ways to cope with that. Either you can try coping with that outside of your language. You can either use your IDE functionality. You can find your IDE. For example, in Eclipse, you can have templates. Or you can actually use a compiler that compiles one language to JavaScript. One example is GWT. But there are also ways to mimic macros from within the language. Let's say, for example, you have the if conditional, which is very verbose and it has a lot of syntactic noise, and you want to do something like an unless macro. One way you can do this is using a functional literal. If I'm going too fast, please stop me if you don't understand something. So you create the function which returns statements, and then you can call it this way. But if you actually see this way has even more syntactic noise than just calling if. So you can improve the same example with the use of the eval function. The eval function is something you can find in most dynamic languages, where you create a function that actually returns a string, which is then evaluated as JavaScript code when you call the unless. There are many things you must consider when you use eval in most dynamic languages, and especially in JavaScript, there are many, in client-side JavaScript, there are many browser-related quirks, so you should use it with caution. Going forward, one more pattern for DSLs are annotations, ways to shove metadata in your objects at runtime. And since JavaScript objects are completely open, you can do that. So we saw how JavaScript implements these DSL patterns, but let's see some things you can do with that. Here's an example. There is a project called JS Class, which is a library designed to give you a way to do Ruby-style object-oriented programming with standard JavaScript. With JS Class, you can have classes and modules, mixins, all sorts of interesting stuff you can find in Ruby. You can even have some of the standard Ruby modules like enumerable, observable, and more from within your language. And here is an example how that works. You define an animal class, the initialize is the constructor, you have a method, and then you create your animal and you call the function. Now with JS class you can do some really interesting things, like you can have method chaining, which feels like macros. You can actually store a sequence of method calls in an object and then execute this sequence of methods in any object you like. This looks something like this. You create the chain object and then you store a sequence of method. In this case you store map, join and replace in it, and then if you want to call this chain of methods, you just use the fire method on the chain object. This is a really nice way to do method chaining, and it's very concise and compact. Now, a general word of advice: in any, if you read how people do JavaScript metaprogramming, you will see a lot of use for the is word. They use a lot of functions named is. In the proposed specifications for the next version of JavaScript, is was a reserved word. Now these proposals were dropped, but there is a great chance that in the future is will be a reserved word, so you should try to avoid using this word as a function name. Now let's talk a little bit about frameworks and how the current frameworks use these techniques. The first framework we're going to see is Dojo, which is one of the most popular toolkits. Dojo is a rather verbose framework. It heavily uses namespaces. Actually, it uses the JavaScript technique that emulates namespaces. They prefer to use full function calls rather than the popular dollar operator. For those that haven't seen the dollar operator in JavaScript before, it was introduced with prototype, and it was like a synonym for the function getElementById, which is something that you call many times when you do DOM manipulation. Of course, these frameworks have added more functionality in this operator than just a plain getDocumentById. Although Dojo was inspired by several other object-oriented languages and programming paradigms, they try to avoid using any patterns from the other languages and try to leverage the patterns that are unique in JavaScript. So this is a quote from one of its creators saying that they rather use the flexibility of JavaScript rather than trying to provide a DSL on top of JavaScript. So does this mean that you cannot have DSL with Dojo? Actually, JavaScript is such an open language that you can pretty easily open it up and tear its guts out and do pretty much whatever you like. So here's a way you can have a dollar operator in Dojo. You use the Dojo mixin function, which is a way to have a mixin type multiple inheritance, and basically as you have the prototype chain, it can shove more objects in that chain so you can inherit them, and it uses it to pretty much give connect dojo.query with the dollar operator. Also, there is plugged for Dojo, which is some functionality built around the basic Dojo the Dojo base. Here's a piece of code that works for Plugged. which means it says get me all the paragraph elements which are of class bus, append to body, add the class bar to them, and then add the event listener, which on click adds some a small HTML string. All these concepts that Plugged supports are taken from jQuery, which is the next framework we're going to see. So jQuery is probably the most widely used JavaScript framework out there. I think it comes with Visual Studio now. It's very easy to use it, and it's very powerful for DOM manipulation. It heavily uses the dollar sign function. It implements CSS selectors, and it really feels like, it doesn't feel like working with JavaScript. It feels like a CSS extension mechanism. So also the CSS, the dollar function not only works like get element by ID, but it also gives additional functionality. And here's an example where you get all the divs that are of class area to be removed and you fade them out. If you tried to do that in plain JavaScript and wanted it to be to support multiple browsers, you would have to write many lines. Also, since these methods return groups of elements, you can have method chaining like this. You get the all the paragraphs and add a class to them and make them show and add some HTML in them. jQuery implements several CSS selectors. For example, get me all the anchor elements that are directly beneath a paragraph. Get me all the paragraph elements that are the first child directly underneath a div. And get me the first row of a table and stuff. These things are highly expressive, and people that do CSS understand these things much better than they understand closures or passing functions around and the prototype-based inheritance. jQuery also has basic support for XPath. Get me all the iframes which have an attribute named ID whose value starts off with a string frame. Get me all the anchor tags that lead to a PDF, and stuff like that. Also, jQuery supports custom selectors. Get me the event paragraphs. Get me all the hidden divs and make them show. Now, in a DOM, you can have elements that are hidden, so and you can make them show and hide without taking them out of the tree. Get me the first paragraph and add the CSS font weight bold, make it bold. Now, we saw one problem domain, which was DOM manipulation. Another problem domain that comes up frequently when you do web development is communicating with the server, doing AJAX. This is pretty much the code you would need to get a page from the server with JavaScript, and if you actually wanted to do something with that page, you would probably have to write, you know, two or three times the same amount of code. But with jQuery, you can do it in a much simpler and elegant way. You just say, get me the element whose ID is my container, and load the page there. So I don't know what your background is, so and maybe CSS selectors look and XPath expressions look weird to you, but they're very close to the people that actually use these libraries. They understand them and they can leverage them. One also interesting project is Event Behavior, which is a prototype plugin which tries to add natural language event programming for prototype. And here is an example, which is like writing plain English, set styles on paragraphs when selects change. Now, event behavior, you can create sentences taking words from these four columns. You have verbs, nouns, events, and conditions. And there are some rules, like you first get one verb, followed by when, followed by at least one event or condition. And if no event is specified, it uses changes. So, and here are a few examples of using event behavior, which again read quite easily. You can add the class name black to a paragraph when color select is black, add bold to paragraph when weight select is bold, or show province field when country is Canada. One more interesting project is OJ, which provides a DSL-style API for writing specs for validating form input and submitting it using AJAX. It's a wrapper around the Yahoo User Interface library, which is a very powerful library, but it makes it much more easily to work with and much more approachable. So here is an example with OJ, which again it's self-documented and you can pretty much understand what it does as you read it. OJ supports again CSS selectors, several CSS selectors. One thing to notice here is that it supports Sizzle, which is a pluggable CSS selector engine, which is used in several different JavaScript frameworks, and it's pretty much a standard by now. Going forward, we can see Project Trim Query, which provides a way to have SQL queries built into your JavaScript code that is executed on the web browser. So, and it provides things like insert, select, the basic stuff you might find in SQL. And it works pretty much like this. First of all, you create your schema. You define your schema. Here we define two tables, invoice and customer. Then you create your data records, and you can do SQL on them like it was a relational database and get your results back in JavaScript objects. Now, as we said earlier on, with HTML5, you have many different new APIs that are starting slowly to be implemented by even major browser vendors. For example, a couple of months ago, Safari 4 beta came out, which supports several of these new APIs. Some of the, and this is not an extensive list, but some of the most interesting APIs are Canvas support for 2D drawing. Like now you will be able to do stuff similar with the stuff you do with Flash, but it will be natively supported by your browser and you will not need to have a plugin and put up with several annoying things that come with plugins. You will have built-in media support, so again you will be able to embed audio and video in your browser and have that without needing any plugin or wrapping it around a Flash file. We will have offline storage. The browsers will have a built-in relational database which will be available through JavaScript APIs. This is actually similar to what Google Gears does. And we will have WebSockets, which is a way to do bidirectional communication with server-side processes. And you can do stuff like comment-style programming, but in a much more reliable manner. So let's take each and every one and look at it how we could improve these APIs with the use of DSL techniques. For example, built-in media support. In a browser supporting HTML5, you could embed a video with this piece of code. You have the video element, and then you can create buttons that call the, to play, pause, and rewind your video. But it would be much more easy and easier to write and understand if we could have a DSL like this, show video and add controls and pass in a literal which says which controls I would like to show. For 2D drawing with Canvas, if you wanted, you could have code looking like this and it would print just a few rectangles around. But if you wanted to do something more meaningful, like do some charting, you would probably want to have something like this, where you define your data and then say plot dot chart type curved area dot with data example data, and you would get your chart. For WebSockets, this is the way you can open a WebSocket to a server that provides WebSockets and pass on messages and read messages and stuff like that, which is pretty straightforward. But if you would like to, make a meaningful application like a stock quotes application, you would probably like something like this: connect to my WebSocket, get quotes for Microsoft stock, and when it falls under $18, alert me. Going forward to offline storage, this is a way to use the API to open a database connection. You have a short name. In the first line, you have a short name for the database, and you have a version number for the database, so you can do lot of testing by changing this version number without having to refactor your database. And then you have a long name, and then you have the expected amount of data that you will be using, and then you can create a transaction that actually executes the SQL. This is not easy code to write, and since you are passing around listeners, you can get into situations where closures are created, where you cannot get out of them. So it would be much easier to have ORM style DSLs on top of this functionality, and for example write something like that: create person, add the name, add the value Jack to the name column, add Redmond to city, and save that in the database. Actually, there is at least one project that tries to build an ORM on top of HTML5 offline storage APIs. I think it's called Juiced or something like that. Now, about creating your own JavaScript DSL, as I said earlier on, there is a very good presentation by Adam Makria. It's about 60 slides, where he goes step by step, and this he creates his own small DSL in JavaScript. I highly recommend that you download it and check it out. Here is an outline of the steps he takes to create his own DSL, which are pretty much the same steps if you try to implement DSL in other languages.
What was the name of working down on that?
It's on the last slide on the references. First of all, you create your specs in natural language. In the case of Adam's example, he has basically a form like the ones you fill in your contact information when you sign up for a service. And he basically wants every time you select the checkbox USA, a drop-down box to appear with all the states. Whereas if you checked in the box Canada, you would have provinces, or anything in Europe, you wouldn't have neither states nor provinces. So here are the specs. Show US state field. When country, select box is USA. Then you find the DSL notation that is closest to the problem domain. Now, the first effort is very close to the language, but it's miles away from the domain. The second approach is very close to the problem domain, and you can actually read it. It reads like plain English. These are actually three functions, as you see. Then he goes on by building each and every function in an iterative and incremental manner. And since if you have a method chaining in JavaScript, it's really easy to have problems with closures and circular references and stuff like that. It really helps to have tests. And this is just some stub code for doing method chaining in JavaScript. As we said before, you create a host object. This host object has three functions. One thing to notice here is all these three functions return the host object. So when you create it, you can call on them, and each and every one returns the host object. There are, you know, many small details when you do this kind of programming with JavaScript, which are beyond the scope of this presentation. So I would suggest also checking out Adam's presentation on metaprogramming. And this pretty much wraps up the presentation.
And exactly on time, you're just done. We didn't have a Chris Sell, so we just picked another random Chris from the audience. So thank you very much. It was excellent.